My name is Dr. Luca. I'm a physician at the CLSC Côte des Neiges, and this is a talk on MacGyver medicine. Who knows who MacGyver is? Excellent. Who doesn't know who MacGyver is? And that's sad that people actually lift up their hand for who doesn't know. MacGyver is the person who everyone should know. MacGyver is the type of guy who can, like, he can do lots of really cool things with very little bits of nothing. Kind of like, you know, if you have duct tape and toothpicks, can you land a 747? And he does these things that are sort of off the wall. In medicine, we try not to do things that are off the wall, but sometimes we're not faced with ideal circumstances. We're faced with real circumstances, and we live in the real world. And often there are a lot of office-based procedures. I've said office-based procedures when you're stuck. In fact, office-based procedures is probably more to the point. Here in Montreal, you guys are spoiled. If you have just about any surgical procedure or any procedure that can be done, you can snap your fingers, make a referral to a tertiary care center and get the specialist to actually do it. In the other 99% of the world, in the real world, you have to kind of do it yourself, and you have to be aware of how to do these procedures. Who am I? I'm a family physician at the CLSC Côte des Neiges. I also work at Le Centre de la Carmier in addiction medicine, and I have an interest in herbal medicine also. Anybody interested in pursuing further interest in addiction medicine can contact Herzl Clinic and do an elective there, and as well as Dollard Carmier. So, MacGyver, if I had some duct tape, I could fix that, and there he is. And speaking of duct tape, there was a study that actually compared the efficacy of duct tape treatment versus liquid nitrogen in the treatment of warts. Let me open the floor. What is a plantar wart?
So it's normally an infectious cause that's causing a wart.
Okay.
So there's a number of different viruses that can cause it, so it's a growth of the skin, it's a hardening of the skin, it's raised.
So infectious cause, outgrowth of the skin. Okay. Keep going. What is a wart? What you said is true. Continue.
It's bothering for the patient.
It's bothering. It could be bothering. What is the area of the virus? What is the area that the virus actually attacks? Yeah, but when we talk about skin, what all the different layers of skin? What's the layer of skin that gets infected with a virus? Yeah, it's the basal layer. It's the bottom layer, the bottommost layer of the area which is infected. And the reason why I'm going into the pathophysiology of the common wart, which is kind of boring, is because how does duct tape work to cure a wart? You kind of have to take a step back and understand what's actually going on in the skin before you can try to appreciate why anyone would even think that duct tape was an option. So you've got in the basal layer, you've got these virus. The virus infects the cells. The cells start replicating, and because the cells start replicating a whole lot, you end up with your outgrowth of skin because they're cells are replicating, but they're not replicating normally. They're infected, and so you end up with an outgrowth, which is painful and bothersome to the patient. The virus does a very good job of attenuating the immune response around it, which is why you can get warts for months, you can get warts for years, because the immune system just doesn't recognize that there's something bad going on there. It does a very good job of hiding all its foreign proteins. When we treat with liquid nitrogen, in fact, any treatment for the common wart short of surgical excision, what happens is every modality involves creating local trauma to the skin and disrupting that basement layer. Once you disrupt the basal layer of the skin cells rupture, the insides go outside, the virus is unable to hide the proteins properly. The consequence is you've got a nonspecific inflammatory response that goes on. Now the immune system gets primed, the immune system goes in, tries to clean things up, and whoa, look at all these viral proteins hanging around. Now the immune system is primed, and the immune system is the one that destroys the virus. But that can't happen until you actually lyse the cells. In cryotherapy, you can destroy the cells quite readily. What happens is you take your cold liquid nitrogen, you hold it onto the wart, and you hold it there for a period of count to 10, count to 20, and just keep doing that a few times, and you're going through a bunch of freeze-thaw cycles. When you do a bunch of freeze-thaw cycles on mammalian cells, they explode. You end up with a lot of ice crystals inside, and you have the desired effect, and it freezes down, it freezes deep, and it will freeze all the way to the basement to the basal layer. Now that I've said this, how does duct tape work? Here's a picture of a wart. How does duct tape work? Why? What's the deal with duct tape?
It doesn't seem there. From what I can imagine, I don't think it would actually affect the basal layer. It doesn't seem deep enough.
Well, it's tape. It's duct tape.
Is it dry?
It doesn't dry at all. No.
When you're pulling it off,
okay, so you're going to cause some superficial trauma as you peel it off. That's not actually if it was that easy, unfortunately, it would be wonderful because you could probably just flick it off with your finger. It's not the direct component of the glue. It's actually, have you guys ever cut yourself? Have you guys ever put a Band-Aid on your skin? What happens when you peel the Band-Aid off? It looks kind of ugly. It looks kind of raised and angry looking, maybe a little macerated. And that's I'm assuming you guys didn't put duct tape on your skin, that you guys actually put a Band-Aid, which is supposed to aerate. When you create an occlusive dressing on the skin, what you're doing is you're preventing the normal aeration of the skin. By preventing the normal aeration, you end up with a little bit of edema. You end up with some autolysis that takes place. And in fact, it's this autolysis, which is thought to be the mechanism by which the warts actually the creates the nonspecific trauma, which in turn promotes your immune response. So there's a picture of a wart, and the objective was to say whether or not duct tape is effective. And is it as effective as cryotherapy? Because let's face it, it's a heck of a lot easier to walk around with a roll of duct tape than it is to walk around with a liter of liquid nitrogen on your back, which is going to evaporate, and you have to then contact your supplier to give you another liter of liquid nitrogen. So, and duct tape is pretty cheap, too. You go to Rano Depot, and you can pick it up. Duct tape, so you got a prospective randomized controlled trial. That's a good thing. It's set in a general pediatric and adolescent clinic at a military medical center in the States. It was a small trial, but it's a cute trial. 61 patients aged 3 to 22, and 51 patients actually completed the study. One of my take-home messages in this study is actually the age 3 to 22. We're talking about young people who do this. We're not talking about 50-year-old diabetics who have vasculopathies. We're not talking about older people who just have really, 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 really thick skin. We're talking about young kids who have thin skin, and that's critical because, remember, the thinner the skin, the easier it is and the more effective it is of any treatment of warts, which is why if you have a really thick skin, you got to pare it down, you got to scrape it off. So the computer randomized the patients. Either they got cryotherapy, which is to be burnt for 10 seconds every 2 to 3 weeks for a maximum of 6 treatments. So you say, okay, I'm going to count to 10 now. 1, 2, 3, count to 10 and take it off and let it relax, let it warm up, and then maybe freeze it a second time. Versus duct tape occlusion for a maximum of 2 months. And we were looking for the resolution of a wart. Of the 51 patients, it actually worked quite well. Cryotherapy was effective in 60% of the time. Duct tape worked in 85% of the time. Most responded to the first month of treatment. So the conclusion is that you could use duct tape as an effective form of treatment for wart removal. That's really kind of cool. No. In fact, you could use it anywhere in the body. I mean, I probably wouldn't put duct tape on my genitalia myself for genital warts. But you could. I'm sure if you had like warts on your hand, or if you have, in principle, the idea of occlusive dressing, it would work. It would work.
Why just duct tape? Have they used other adhesives or things like that?
I have no idea. I suspect they use duct tape just because it's really, really sticky and it'll stick to anything. Okay. And so you can cut a little piece off and you can put it there, and it's going to stay there for at least a good few hours. And when it falls off, you can put it, cut another little piece and put it there. It costs pennies or less to put a little bit of duct tape on that stick. And then as long as you're ensuring that it's always covered, you're going to create maceration in that area. And you're just going to basically slowly dig down. As long as the duct tape is there, it'll take weeks. It could take a month or two. And certainly in the pediatric population, it'll be much faster than, say, in an adult population. But it'll work. Why? And I mean, could masking tape work? I don't know. Maybe masking tape wouldn't stick as much. Maybe it'll tend to aerate more. I don't know. Other ways of removing warts, you can basically do anything that will shave it from the top down. You can't really start from the inside out, but you start from the top down, so you can grind it off with a stone. You can put acid on it, like salicylic acid. You can soak it, and then you can soak it and grind it, soak it and put acid. Use mix and match. Use all of those treatments. And then ultimately, when you end up in the doctor's office, you want to also dig down more aggressively with a scalpel. If it's soft, it's much more easier. And then apply your treatment of choice, which is to burn with liquid nitrogen or use duct tape. Personally, I use liquid nitrogen because I have it in the office. But if you didn't have it, duct tape isn't a bad option. So let's go away from duct tape and let's go into some more primary care physician procedures. What procedures have you guys done in the office? Pap tests. What else? You name me a procedure that you have done, not necessarily in family medicine, but a procedure that you've done.
Incision and draining.
IND.
Vaccination.
Reduction of joint?
Joint reduction. No, I'm assuming this was in the eMERGE. I hope it was in the eMERGE. Good. Okay, but good.
Urine dipstick, glucose test.
Good.
We did an Ingram toenail.
Ouch! Good. Excellent. Was this in family medicine?
Yeah.
Very good.
IUD removal?
IUD removal. Very good. So you guys have all done at least one procedure, and that's really good. In fact, they did a survey in 2001 of Canadian family physicians, and they said, do you guys do procedures? And well, these were the results that we got. Pap smear, suturing, minor surgery, skin biopsy, EKGs, IUD, needle aspiration, endoscopies, pulmonary function test, lumbar puncture. Whatever procedures you guys end up doing in your office, make sure that you make it standard of care for the community where you're practicing. And I work here at the CLSC Côte-des-Neiges, downtown Montreal. I have also worked in Wakeham Bay, Anangava Bay, which is extremely remote. And to do a lumbar puncture here at the CLSC Côte-des-Neiges, one could even argue that that would be reckless. Why? Because if you're sick enough to warrant a lumbar puncture, probably you should walk across the street and go to the eMERGE. You've got a whole lot of resuscitative equipment there. Probably you're going to need some form of antibiotics. You're probably going to need some form of other interventions. Lumbar puncture is not high on my list of things to do down here. Having said that, the same doctor with the same equipment, if I find myself in a much more remote community and I say, you need a lumbar puncture, and the alternative is to wait a week or try to arrange for a flight or do a medical evacuation down here to Montreal by flight, which can add up on costs, time, and a lot of unnecessary mobilization of resources, a lumbar puncture suddenly becomes much more relevant for the same family doctor to do up there than it is to do down here. So whatever you end up doing, and whatever you can mix and match and pick and choose what you want to do, make sure that it's relevant to your practice of whatever you find yourself doing. Pap smears, notice that it was extremely high, suturing is extremely high, joint injection aspiration quite high, EKGs quite high, IUD insertions quite high. All of these 50% to almost 90% of physicians do these procedures. These are not surgeons, these are family doctors. Minor surgery and other procedures, comprises minor surgeries and other procedures? Circumcision, cosmetics, cryotherapy, IND lumps and bumps, toenail removals, vasectomy, acupuncture, endometrial biopsy, nerve block, travel vaccinations, obstetrical work, joint aspiration and injection. So we're going to actually talk about some of these procedures. I've been picking on this side of the room. Let's pick on this side of the room. Why would you want to inject a joint?
For pain control.
Okay. Can you be more specific?
I think in osteoarthritis, some of the
later
advanced treatment is to inject
corticosteroids. Certainly. It could be. Why? What exactly are you doing when you're injecting a joint?
You're inhibiting the inflammatory
response. Right. So, in fact, if you have pain or osteoarthritis or any acute process, typically I would side more towards acute processes as opposed to chronic irreversible processes like osteoarthritis. But if you had an acute process going on in your joint, or in, I say joint, but I mean bursas also, or tendons, if you want to have an anti-inflammatory response, you want to be able to get steroids there, and you could crank the person up with oral steroids and cause a significant number of systemic effects, or you could actually inject a very high dose right at a very local area and achieve the desired treatment. We're not going to go and go through each and every joint. In short, what happens is you've got your steroids, methylprednisolone, which is one of the steroids which is used a lot. Triamcinolone is also a steroid which happens to be used a lot. You've got a dose, which is also converted to a volume. It can be intermixed with 1-to-1 lidocaine as a topical anesthetic, as an anesthetic that can be injected also. You find your anatomy and you inject. That's it. In terms of tables like this, find a table in your clinic, know where to access it. When you have to do an injection, read the table. That's the easiest way to do it. Unless you do many injections often, always refer back to your table and always refer back to your anatomy. Netter is quite useful at picking out your anatomy and determining where you can and where you cannot inject. So let's talk about the shoulder bursas and shoulder joints. Basically what you're seeing here is you can inject anteriorly, you can inject from the lateral approach and from the anterior approach, and the goal here is to go in to you're trying to get to the bursa. You take a long needle, 21 gauge, 1.5, load it up with your syringe, again with your appropriate volume of steroid, and some lidocaine can be used to help cause some immediate relief, and then you make an injection. Shortly after the injection, sometimes within 12 hours, you can get a flare-up, and it can actually get a little bit worse, and then afterwards it can get better. The lidocaine helps to give pain relief in that short flare-up in the beginning. Elbow joint. Again, you can inject the elbow from just about any way that you want. Knee joint. When the knee joint is extended, you can approach it from the medial aspect. It's probably the easiest way. You can also approach it from the lateral aspect. and the goal here is to get the needle into the bursa. What happens if you don't get it into the bursa?
Well,
you miss.
You're missing, yeah.
What happens? So what?
Well, you're not going to be injecting it into the bursa. You can have sort of atrophy or the corticosteroid has an effect on the local tissue. So you can create atrophy, you can damage nerves, you can damage vessels.
Okay.
You can...
What you said is true. What you said is kind of worst-case scenario in the doom and gloom scenario, but what you're saying is true. The gold standard is to get it into the bursa. In fact, in terms of atrophy or in terms of ligament or tendon atrophy, you can actually, if you do repeated injections, you can actually, even if you do get it into the bursa, you can still run into these complications. Repeated injections gets you onto thinner ice and different joints you want to inject fewer times and to help to alleviate the risks of, say, tendon rupture or skin atrophy or skin discoloration. If you don't get it into the bursa, assuming that you know your anatomy and assuming that you've done your approach properly, you're not going to get into nerves, you're not going to get into blood vessels. If you're trying to inject the C2, C3 joint, yeah, you could get into some serious trouble. Don't do that. But if you're injecting a knee, or if you're injecting an elbow, or you're injecting a shoulder, assuming that you're comfortable with your anatomy and with your landmarks, you can do the injection. You're not going to interfere with any of the other structures you mentioned. If you don't get it into the bursa, the short answer is, it's not the end of the world. Purists will say, you don't get it into the bursa, it's worth nothing. In fact, if you bathe the entire area in steroids, you can actually still have an effect, even if you don't get it into the bursa. You should aim for the bursa. Aim for gold. But don't have a panic attack if you don't get it. If you're saying, oh my God, am I in? Am I not? Am I in? Am I not? Am I in? Am I not? I think I have to go left. I think I have to go right. Oh, no. Don't worry about it. You give it your best shot, and you give an injection, and that's it. What would be contraindications to injections? Okay, so hemophilia. Can you think of a contraindication to a joint injection? Abnormal anatomy. Can you give me an example?
Patient has a fracture.
Okay. A fracture. Sure. The person comes into the emerge and says, you know, I think I broke my elbow. Don't and you got a fracture on the X-ray. Please don't inject it.
I was going to say, you know, joint replacement. You wouldn't want to inject a replacement.
Yeah, you would lose points for that.
With allergy to.
Intolerance to lidocaine. Intolerance to steroids shouldn't happen, but if intolerance to lidocaine, if you could still inject, just don't use the lidocaine.
I'm saying if you could possibly think of a septic joint.
Sure, septic joint, big thing. Don't inject a septic joint. If you're pretty sure that they don't have an aseptic joint, go right ahead and inject. But if the light is lit up, that's a red flag. Please don't inject into a septic joint.
Well, I imagine if you intend to aspirate the joint at all, you know, if you're looking for gout or anything like that, then it wouldn't really make sense to be injecting something at the moment.
It would actually not, but it, notice how I think the beginning of the slide was injection and aspiration. In fact, let us suppose that this individual had gout on his knee or had an inflammation that we wanted to aspirate what was going on in the knee. The procedure is actually identical, except what you do is once you get the needle in, clamp it with a little hemostat clamp, withdraw. Instead of going in with a needle loaded with a syringe loaded with anesthetic and with steroids, just withdraw, put it down, screw on the one that you're injecting, and then inject.
Yeah.
So you can actually do both. You're right, though. You don't want to inject first and then withdraw. You're just withdrawing what you just injected. That's kind of silly. But if you were suspicious of, say, you wanted to send off the fluid for culture or send the fluid off for crystals or whatnot, you could actually withdraw first and then inject. What would be another reason, another contraindication?
Maybe if they have a lot of osteophytes and everything.
Sure. So the individual has severe osteoarthritis, and the joint normally should be this big, and their joint is this big. You're going to say the anatomy is abnormal. In fact, that goes back to what you said when you said abnormal anatomy, fracture, joint replacement, or osteoarthritis, all of which can get encompassed into this area, into this zone of abnormal anatomy. If you don't have, if you're not sure of your landmarks, don't do it.
What about if someone's very immunosuppressed?
Would that be contraindicated? It would make me a little bit worried. I would have to ask the question: why are they immunosuppressed, and is that at all related to the pathology that's going on here? Although it doesn't increase the probability of a septic joint, if the septic joint lights up in your head, you probably shouldn't inject with steroids. You can aspirate and send it off for culture, and if you get back pus, you might want to give them antibiotics and like give them high dose IV antibiotics. But it wouldn't actually be a straight contraindication per se.
I wonder if from my peripheral vascular disease. Because, I mean, for people who are at increased risk of infection in the periphery.
It shouldn't be. I probably wouldn't want to inject the distal phalanx of the little toe in somebody who's got diabetic nephropathy and diabetic neuropathy. But to be fair, I probably wouldn't inject it in you or me either. The joint itself is pretty deep. And the vascular supply of the actual joint is actually pretty good, even in people who have compromised vasculature. So I would be more worried about infection. Certainly, if an infection occurred in that individual versus somebody who was young and healthy, the person who was young and healthy, you could probably give them antibiotics and be fine. The individual with poor vasculature may actually lose the limb, and you may result in amputation. So if things go bad, they would tend to go catastrophically bad, and that would be maybe a source of concern. Interphalangeal joints and tendon sheaths. Sure, if you're comfortable injecting fingers, you are welcome to. Personally, I don't. I have never done this procedure, and I probably never will. I've said don't do it unless you're desperate. I'd say don't do it unless you're extremely comfortable. At issue is that you have much smaller margins of error on fingers than, say, you do with a big knee. Maybe I'm a chicken, but I don't like injecting fingers and toes and stuff like that. That's it for injection. And as for the aspiration part, it's the same thing. As I mentioned, once the needle goes in, just withdraw instead of inject. And then switch syringes and withdraw. It's only one needle and the needle stays in. Fine needle aspiration of a breast lump. You come into my office. Doc, I'm here for a physical exam. Let's do a breast exam. And I say, you have a bump. You have a lump there. At that point, a decision can be made. I can say, forget about it, it's completely benign and it looks benign and it should be benign, and I make my diagnosis on clinical grounds and that's the end of it, which is fine. Or I can say, you're a 40-year-old smoker, it's a new solitary lesion, could be bad. Let's send you for an ultrasound, let's send you for a mammogram. But it takes time. You're a busy person, you have to work. You need to get the results. The mammogram is going to say, well, we're not sure. The ultrasound is going to say, we're not sure. Maybe we need to actually get a tissue on the inside. In the interim, how well do you think you're going to be sleeping?
Pretty poorly.
pretty poorly. Yeah. Fine needle aspiration can actually be done in your office. If it's a superficial enough lesion, and if your landmarks are good enough, you can actually do a fine needle aspiration right then and there in your office. And you can get pretty good results pretty quickly. It's inexpensive, easy to perform, no advanced preparation, virtually painless, and can be done in the office. So I'm going to say, you know what? Instead of taking that route, I'm going to take option number two. I'm going to say, you have another 10 minutes. We're going to clean the area. I'm going to use a long needle, maybe a 2-inch needle, hook it onto a syringe. I'm going to go in. I might freeze the area. I might not even freeze the area. And I put the needle in. I'm withdrawing. And if I get the cyst and I withdraw clear or straw-colored fluids, I say, listen, this is a benign cyst. If you want to dot your I's and cross your T's and be anal retentive, I can still send you for a mammogram and an ultrasound, but take a deep breath and relax, because this is pretty sure that this is a benign pathology. In fact, if it's clear or straw-colored that comes back, they don't even recommend sending it for cytology. In fact, they just say, just toss it, and you got your diagnosis as a benign cyst, forget it. And if you're not sure, well, send it to cytology and have the pathologist tell you that it's benign. In fact, when you did a fine needle aspiration, there was a lot of studies that were done, and these were in the 1990s. They demonstrated that it has satisfactory 90 to 95% of cases, accuracy rate of 95%, sensitivity 97%. There was one false positive and 14 false negatives. Clearly, what would be the limitations of fine needle aspiration?
Histology.
Sorry?
Histology.
So if the cells are funny looking, but then the pathologist will tell you your cells are funny looking. But what would be the biggest, the single biggest problem with doing a fine needle aspiration?
Not knowing if it's
DCIS
versus.
No, not even. It's technique. You guys are thinking way too hard. Technique. If the lump is here and the needle goes in here, what's the pathologist going to say? It's a normal tissue. I didn't get it. If you miss the mark, you're doing a useless procedure. This is the biggest drawback of fine needle aspiration. In fact, it's very I don't want to say operator dependent, because it's very doctor dependent. You got to actually get the needle into the lesion.
To actually miss the lesion.
It depends on the individual.
An average individual, it's not very good.
On an average,
it depends on the
size. If you're trying to get like a pea, or if you're trying to get a softball, clearly it makes a difference. If this is your first aspirate, or if you've done 1,000 aspirates, it makes a difference. But in fact, the studies did mention that it all of the studies were actually quite positive, and ours up there with some in the 90s% in terms of specificity, sensitivity. Retrospective analysis of 420 patients who did fine needle aspirate versus those who had an open biopsy, open surgery. 81% had benign pathologies, which is good, because you don't want to send them all to surgery if they have ultimately a benign pathology. You've got a very high accuracy, sensitivity, specificity. Clearly, it's dependent on the technical skills of the physician and of the cytopathologist. So if the pathologist is out to lunch, there's your second weakest link. And if those two are good, both you and the cytopathologist, then it's a fairly effective procedure. And you can get results right away. As I said, if it comes back clear or straw-colored, good for you. You've got your diagnosis. IUD insertion. How many people have done an IUD insertion? Yeah, helped with one. Good. Anyone else? Did anyone else help with one? Has anyone helped with one? What?
I watched.
You watch. Okay. Good. Pass me the tenaculum. Okay. Has anyone ever, for other people, have you actually seen an IUD insertion? You did. Good. And you guys. Okay. This is an IUD. In fact, that's the IUD inserted. This is an IUD. I lied. So, what is an IUD? Good. What does it do?
It's a form of contraception.
How?
Well, there's two types. You create localized inflammation from a copper IUD, or if you have progestin, then you're working by, you know, affecting the local growth of the endometrium and the secretions.
Good.
Or all of the above.
Yeah. And what would be, so indications for an IUD would be?
Birth control.
Number one, good.
Especially like kind of long-term birth control.
Long-term birth control. I don't want to take the pill every day. I forget to take the pill every day. I can't take the pill every day. In the long term, I understand that it's financially more economical. I just don't want to have to be bothered with other forms of contraception. Good.
Can't tolerate the side effects of hormonal control?
Sure. Okay. What would be another indication, if we go away from the contraception aspect, what would be another indication for an IUD?
So if you want the effects of progesterone on the endometrium.
Which would cause what, from a clinical standpoint?
So it's shedding, so you don't want...
It's used to treat dysmenorrhea.
Dysmenorrhea, if you have painful periods, if you have big periods, sure, you can use a Mirena. Please don't use a copper because that will make it worse. But you can use a Mirena. It helps to thin the endometrium. It helps to make your uterine lining thinner. And some people, it may actually result in amenorrhea. For some women, they are very happy with this. For some women, they are very upset with this. From a medical standpoint, it's neither here nor there, but at least counsel the patient so that they are aware that this is what is going on. When you do the procedure, as with all procedures, you want to explain it to the patients. You want, what are contraindications to IUD insertion?
Undiagnosed
vaginal bleeding.
Occurrent sexual transmitted infection.
Sorry?
Occurrent STI.
Current STIs, sure. Or high risk STI. Yeah.
Yeah. History of PID.
History of PID, which would go along with history of STI.
You have to make sure they're not
pregnant. Make sure they're not pregnant. Please do not insert an IUD in a pregnant woman.
Well, especially for like copper IUDs, if somebody's already having like menorrhagia, then you don't want to send copper IUDs. Sure.
Good.
Sure.
You got a bifid uterus. You don't. Please don't insert an IUD. There is a contraindication for this one.
For the copper?
Yes. Wilson's disease. If you have excess copper, you don't want to insert. You don't want to give them more copper. So basically, as with all surgical procedures, you want to explain the procedure, infection prevention. So you want to sterilize the area. You want to clean the area. It is not a sterile procedure, but it is a clean procedure. Generally speaking, it's a two-visit process. The first visit, you talk to the patient, get the consent and everything, and please do cultures at that point. Ensure that the individual is not at high risk for STDs, which is not an absolute contraindication, but it is a relative contraindication. When you do the procedure, on the day of the procedure, she shows up with her packet with her IUD. You want to do a bimanual exam. You want to establish whether or not the uterus folds forward, whether or not the uterus folds backwards. You want to sound the uterus. Oh no! You want to take a sound, which is a metal, a blunt metal flexible rod with little lines on it. This is not a uterine sound. This is an IUD inserter. But let's assume that this is metal and soft. What you do is you want to insert it into the uterus to establish how deep the uterus is, and you say, "Oh look, it's 7 centimeters." So you pull it out, and you know that it's 7 centimeters long because you can actually look at the lines and say, landed on 7. At which point, you take your IUD inserter, whether it's the copper or the Mirena, you put your marker at 7 centimeters, do not go past that marker. If you go past that marker, what does that mean? you perforated, or you're not where you think you are, or your sounding wasn't appropriate. But generally speaking, that's there you go. You also don't want to go, if it's less than 5 centimeters, you also don't want to insert an IUD. If it's, the uterus is too small or too big, or if it's 5 centimeters, you're not in the uterus, there's something wrong. As with any medical procedure, if something's wrong, always ask yourself the question, can I just stop and walk away? Have you passed the point of no return? If you haven't passed the point of no return, if at all you're concerned, and this applies for any of these procedures that we're talking about, you've got to a point and you say, uh-oh, that shouldn't be happening. If you're not past the point of no return, you can stop. In fact, if you run into a curveball, it's probably not a bad idea to stop, regroup, replan, figure out what's going on before plowing through. When you plow through, that's when you start making serious medical errors. Did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Then what you do is you insert the IUD mechanism into it and you pop it in.
Do you feel anything for pain?
So on the day of the procedure, you can tell the woman to actually take 2 tablets of Advil, 400 milligrams of ibuprofen right then and there, and she can take another 400 milligrams when she goes home. And because what happens is the actual insertion can be painful, and afterwards you can end up with uterine cramps. I'm going to pass this around. In short, this is a Mirena, and with a funky inserter. And it starts with the system like this. And what happens is you want to load it first, pull it back, it's loaded. You've got the uterus, which is nice and convenient. You want to first use your sounding instrument. You say, oh, look, it's 7 centimeters. So now it's 7 centimeters. And when you push it up to the cervix, you can say, good, I've got my 7 centimeters. And now you want to effectively withdraw. And that's it. Now you want to withdraw, and now you want to pull out. And notice how the strings are staying. This instrument has a little tie on the end because this is a demonstration purposes, but basically this pulls out completely. And then you use your scissors and go snip, or snip. And then you've got your cords that are on the outside in the vaginal area, and you've got the IUD which floats around in the uterus. And it stays like that for up to about 5 years. If you want to remove an IUD, you can do what you just saw me do. Effectively, to remove an IUD, you just pull on the strings and it comes out. And it should come out as easy as pulling it out here. If it doesn't, you've done something wrong or something weird has happened. Possibly it's embedded itself into the myometrium. Possibly it's twisted in a knot and you just have to tug a little harder. Whatever it is, again, stop, regroup, recheck your anatomy, recheck your what you're doing, and make sure you're doing it properly. I'm going to pass this around. You can insert the IUD as many times as you want. No. 99, okay. I say no because I don't have access to an ultrasound. I would argue that most people don't have access to an ultrasound. You would... In terms of insertion of an IUD, you would do that. You would want to use an ultrasound if you weren't sure about the anatomy, if you weren't sure about if there was like fibroids inside, if you were concerned about bifid uterus, if you were concerned about something. But one would argue that if you were that concerned and you wanted to get an ultrasound, you probably shouldn't be inserting an IUD at that point.
Okay.
Do your investigations first. Make sure you know what you're doing first. Yeah. Make sure the diagnosis is solid. Then proceed.
Okay, the doctor, he had one, so after every insert.
He just checked to say, oh, look, it's in.
You could.
In fact, a month later, it's a good idea to ask the woman to come back, and you can verify the position of the cords. You should be able to feel the cords.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if you cut the cords too long, sometimes she can complain that she can feel them or her partner can feel them, and you can cut them a little bit shorter. What happens if you cut the cords too short?
Can't
pull ahead. At which point, what happens? These can stay in the uterus for up to 5 years. What happens after 5 years?
DNC.
You could do a DNC. You don't have to, in fact. It's a blind procedure. I've never done it, and it's not part of this lecture, but effectively, there's a blind procedure where you just take long forceps and just go in and...
Sure.
It's in there somewhere, and you can pull it out. Again, I don't do it. But what would happen? So you come back a month later, and you don't see the cords. What do you do? Maybe it fell out. Maybe the cords went in. So you're going to tell the woman, well, maybe you're protected for 5 years, but maybe you'll get pregnant next month. I don't know. What do we do?
Ultrasound.
You could do an ultrasound, yeah. You could do an x-ray, too. In fact, pelvic x-ray is probably easier and more readily available than a bedside ultrasound. In fact, x-ray is remarkably easy. Do an x-ray. These are all radio opaque materials. And so you take the x-ray. If you see it, it'll like light up with your big T. And if you don't see it, then it means it's been expelled. And if you do see it, then you know it's there. You can just tell the woman, well, don't worry about it for the next 5 years. Levonorgestrel, progesterone IUD, Mirena. It's as effective as copper-based. It can... It's nice for dysmenorrhea. It lightens bleedings. It has. It is extremely effective form of contraception. Apparently, the risk of PID is lower with Mirena than with copper. Although I wouldn't necessarily put it to the test, just because this tends to be more irritating. This tends to send the message that the shop is closed. When they look at cumulative discontinuation rates per 100 women by device and by year, 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, what we're seeing is that overall they're pretty equal. Nova-T tends to have a slightly higher discontinuation rate. The parts where the Mirena loses points is hormonal side effects. Even though there is not very much progesterone and it's only acting locally, there is some systemic absorption, and some women can complain of side effects related to the Mirena and to the progesterone. There's no hormone in the copper, so you're not going to get hormonal side effects. That's about it. And pregnancy, obviously, is a nice reason why you might want to stop taking your IUD. An endometrial biopsy. Endometrial biopsy is to... IUD insertion as joint aspiration is to joint injection. Effectively, the pretest is the same. The contraindications are pretty similar. The indications, why do you want to do an endometrial biopsy? Postmenopausal bleeding. And every combination associated with a postmenopausal bleeding. And the key here is you don't do an endometrial biopsy in a young, healthy woman. You do them in postmenopausal women. If you have postmenopausal bleeding, if you're bleeding after continuous HRT, if you have an abnormal pap smear showing atypical endometrial cells in a postmenopausal woman, if you're on tamoxifen or follow-up and you have vaginal bleeding, endometrial hyperplasia, if you're concerned about the inside of the uterus, you want to do an endometrial biopsy. And an endometrial biopsy, I'm going to cheat and I'm going to use this and call it a endometrial biopsy pipel. It's not. It's to insert as a copper T inserter, but we'll call it a endometrial biopsy. Basically, you have a plunger inside. You have a little cup of formalin beside you, and you you can imagine that this is the plunger. It is inside the tube. You insert it into the uterus. Again, this is the blind procedure. And you just start withdrawing your plunger. And what you're doing is you're creating a suction in here. And then you're just blindly withdrawing. And you've withdrawn all the way to the end, and you have a nice long area of bloody tissue. You take it out, you put it into your formalin, you spit it out into the formalin tissue, into the formalin container, and send it off for pathology. That's the endometrial biopsy. It's got pretty good sensitivity and pretty good specificity. If you didn't want to do an endometrial biopsy and you were worried about endometrial cancer, what other procedures could you do? What other options do you have?
You could look for hyperplasia, just through imaging, but that's not
how.
Ultrasound.
Send it for an ultrasound. Exactly. Send it for an ultrasound. If you end up with endometrial hyperplasia, you'll see it in an ultrasound, your index of suspicion of getting worried goes up. If you see some really funny things on ultrasound, then yeah.
What's the chance of missing pathology when you're doing lines, endometrial biopsy?
So there was a study that compared endometrial biopsy up to DNCs. DNC is where you're actually opening it up and it's no longer blind. You're actually you're doing what you're doing and you're removing the entire endometrial lining. An endometrial biopsy had a 90% agreement, sensitivity of 83% to 96% for endometrial cancer. And certainly, if you do a biopsy and you still have abnormal bleeding and the biopsy was normal, don't stop. Refer the patient or do something else. Maybe you do miss. But it's pretty good. It's pretty good. If you got a less than 4 millimeter ultrasound, less than 4 millimeter thickness of your endometrium, don't be too worried about it. So what do you do? Again, you've got your NSAIDs. There's your biopsy bipel with your plunger that you are withdrawing, and you're twirling it around and you're picking up different areas. You're basically taking a random sampling of the tissues on the inside. Emergency contraception. Emergency contraception, the first thing that comes to mind is this guy who runs into a date by nurse saying, quick, it's an emergency, I need a condom. but this is not what emergency contraception is in this case. Emergency contraception, also known as postcoital contraception, it's a sexual intercourse has occurred and it was unprotected. Quick. Why could this happen?
So you can have failure or whatever method you were using.
The condom broke. I forgot to take my pill for the past 2 weeks.
No, they just didn't use
it. I just didn't use it. Right.
Just like lack of education kind of thing. Like they use the pulling out method.
Sure. Timing method. Uh-oh. Or pulling out.
You didn't have a condom on?
Didn't have a condom on, and I have to have sex now. Yeah.
They weren't prepared. They didn't. They realized later on.
Okay.
The next day.
Great.
Yeah.
So, I think that covers most of the bases. Either you don't have the contraception, either it was consensual, non-consensual, or hey, if you were intoxicated, if you were drunk, and you showed up and you wake up the next morning, and you say, "What happened? And why am I sore down there?" You might want to think about emergency contraception. Emergency contraception, it is effective. The standard original form of emergency contraception involves Ovral. It's a high-dose birth control pill where you basically take 2 Ovrals now along with a Gravol, and 12 hours from now you take another 2 Ovrals and you take a Gravol. And you tell the woman that she's going to be sick.
You can tell them to take their own, like 3 or something?
You got it. There's nothing magical about Ovral. In fact, you can use, I don't have Ovral, Doc. I only have Marvelon. I only have Alessa. I only have Tricyclin. Whatever, as long as you do the appropriate conversion, it's all the same. The only thing I would caution you is don't use the green pills in the pack. Those are the sugar ones. Those are the placebo. They won't work. The other thing to be cautious of is if the person has a birth control pill, you want to do the appropriate conversion on the appropriate level that they have. It's not because all pills are not created equal. That's the only cautionary flag if you're using a triphasic one. So Ovral does tend to be the first and foremost one, but again, you can use any other form of birth control pill. It all works. Plan B is actually marketed for emergency contraception. It's a progesterone only. You tend to have much fewer nausea and you tend to get a lot less sick. You take it once now and once in 12 hours. And you can actually get an IUD insertion. You know what? I'm at high risk. I know that this is going to happen again and again and again. I don't want to keep taking emergency contraception. What do I do? It's been less than... I believe the window, I don't know what the window time is, it's either 72, 96 hours. Sorry? Yeah, I think 72 hours tends to be the number that comes to mind, but I'm not 100% sure. You can get an IUD inserted, and you can go right ahead and you do that.
I know this is like a one-time thing, so I mean, the contraindications to OCP wouldn't really apply, like, you know.
Absolutely. But my mother had breast cancer, but, you know, if the person had, like, acute hepatitis at the same time, I probably wouldn't do it. But if the person had chronic hep C that wasn't active at that time, I wouldn't worry about giving this. If the person had migraines, if the person had had a DVT a year ago, no, you're absolutely right. The regular risk factors for the regular contraindications for contraception, long-term use, is all over long terms, not in an acute setting, one-time event. If you were, you would have to be very, very, very unlucky to actually get a DVT from a dose of Overal over a 24-hour period.
For Overal, do you have to go to a doctor to get it, or is it like Plan B and you can get it from your pharmacist?
I believe you would have to go to a doctor. Plan B, I believe you can get it directly from a pharmacist. In some areas, I don't know if this is Quebec or other provinces or even other states, there are Aldanas Collective where you can get a 3-month supply of birth control over a without having seen a doctor. As long as the follow-up is done afterwards and the nurse is trained and experienced in doing so. So under that context, and in fact here at the CLSC, the nurses can give the emergency contraception appropriately without having to go through the doctor. The point is, from an emergency contraception standpoint, it's extremely safe. I would go so far as to say there are not any contraindications to emergency contraception, short of desired pregnancy, but they probably wouldn't be in your office at the time. So, to say how effective is it, you got to ask yourself what is the efficacy of, what is the probability that you're going to get pregnant. So when you do population-based studies, and you, quick, let's hide that slide. When you do a population-based study and you say, what is the likelihood that you're going to get pregnant if you have sex, unprotected sex?
Well, normally the studies are over sort of a month of regular, so I don't know what the one time.
It's actually over a year, and it's 80%. So after a year of regular sexual activity, 80% will become pregnant of not using contraception. But what is it, a single point episode?
Less than 20,
you're right. 5%. Give me a number. 15%.
It depends on
the age. It depends on a lot of different things. I mean, if you're having sex while the person's menstruating, you're probably not going to, you're pretty safe that you're not going to get pregnant. But on the other hand, if you're having sex in that critical window, the probability of getting being pregnant goes up. It's certainly the age of the woman. If the woman is 70 years old, the probability of getting pregnant is probably pretty poor. So, I mean, clearly there are other factors, but in terms of averages, for somebody who could get pregnant.
2, 3,
or 1.
So let's say 45.
It's about 8%, actually. Mm-hmm. Roughly speaking, it's about 8%. 7%, 8% is the number that bat around. So once we know that there's a plateau effect, this is a graph of people who have taken the emergency contraception. These are the hours after unprotected sex, and this is the pregnancy rate. And what we find is that, in fact, the curve goes up. If we were to continue the curve, it would plateau somewhere around here. And it would plateau around 7%, 8%, because that's background. Not everyone gets pregnant. So it's important to know where the curve ends. And clearly what we see is that the sooner that you take the emergency contraception, the more effective it is. In fact, if you're within 12 hours, you can knock that probability down to 0.5%. If you're up to 72 hours, now we've gone 3 days, you're up to 4%. It's still better than 7% or 8%, but it's not as good as 0.5%. Let's say you fall into that 0.5%. And the woman comes back a month later and says, "Doc, I didn't get my period. I took those pills. I didn't vomit. I did everything I was supposed to do. And I don't have my period. I did a pregnancy test, and it's positive." What does that mean?
You're pregnant.
Okay. So now what? But I took the emergency contraception, Doc. Yeah, but like, is my baby going to be born with like 5 arms and 8 legs?
Well, no, I don't think there's any risk to it.
Okay. It is a contraindication to give birth control to a pregnant woman. That's sort of a duh statement. But it's not, it does not create any medical risks. No medical risks have been demonstrated to be imparted onto the child as a result of having taken the emergency contraception. Basically, as you said, you're pregnant. Congratulations. Now you've got another whole series of issues and thoughts to consider.
Why are you
scheduled 15 minutes? Yeah. So, help from your hardware store. Here's an article from a physician in St. John's, from the Canadian Family Physician, and I don't know the... I can't read it at all, but in short, what he's telling you is that in practice, you're not too useful if you don't have a Dremel tool and you don't have a pair of bolt cutters, which I think is quite funny and quite odd until you start realizing that this is a guy who works in a very rural and fishing village where we're not talking about the little teeny tiny hooks that you can buy at like Walmart. We're talking about like fish hooks that if you get caught in your hand, you've got serious problems, at which point bolt cutters come in handy quite nicely. And you also have Dremel tools that can be double as a drill. So if you ever want to drill a hole into someone, you've got your Dremel tool. If you want to cut, you can use a cutting disc on a Dremel tool, and you can cut through steel. And you can also put a little sander onto the end, and you can pare down very aggressively either nails or calluses with your Dremel tool. Hey, it works! Go to Reno Depot. Bada-bing, we got it. You know the ads. The bottom line is anything goes as long as what you're doing is appropriate for your clinical practice. I have no use for bolt cutters at the CLSC Côte des Neiges. I think that my mental health patients would get worried if they showed up and they saw a pair of bolt cutters and a drill. But in this context, it works. An ingrown toenail, the ugly icky slides are coming up. Basically, you've got anywhere, stage 1, stage 2, stage 3. Stage 1 is a little bit of pain, a little bit of swelling. Stage 2, you're starting to get a little discharge. It's starting to make your socks go a little green, and it's starting to get really uncomfortable. And stage 3, you've got this chronic tissue going on. You've got granulation tissues going on. You've got risks of infection, lots of pain. Bad. What does an ingrown toenail... How do we treat an ingrown toenail? You can... Simple avulsion, which is just taking a step back, pathophysiology. You've got skin on the bottom of your foot. You've got nail on the top of your foot. And the two are locked into a constant battle between good and evil. No, the two are locked in a constant battle. And basically what's happening is the skin is always trying to go up and the nail is always trying to go down. And as long as the two are in proper balance, you're fine. You've got what's called a toe and a nail. What happens is you kind of wear stylish shoes, or your nail doesn't work, starts losing ground, and every time you step down, you're kind of like pushing the skin up, and you're twisting things around, and the poor nail loses the advantage. And what happens is the skin now starts to win over. Now the nail's still going to try and push forward, but you've got the skin that's kind of over and it's getting stuck and it's creating an icky and pain, and my toes are my breakfast is starting to say hi to me. And so what happens is simple avulsion includes, put your hand like this, show me a nail, show me your finger. Good. So a simple avulsion involves, let me get a scalpel out, no. Simple avulsion involves basically just kind of going like this. There. Back to normal. Problem solved. Well, it hasn't really solved because what happens is often it tends to come back. So that's what simple avulsion is. In fact, recurrence rate is anywhere from 60 to 78%. If you have a stage 1, it's not a bad, or even a stage 2, it's not necessarily a bad option to do. The risks are quite small. You can just do it. I mean, it takes 10 seconds and it's done. But you can end up with other procedures, which are tend to be more effective. Total nail bed ablation. You can basically shoot the nail up with phenol and just basically destroy the nail bed. Radical excision of the nail fold. So you can actually like do major surgery here. Wedge resection, which involves cutting out part of the nail and ripping it out. But unfortunately, these still have a recurrence rate of 20%, roughly speaking.
That has like a very low recurrence rate, but they don't have to touch the nail; they cut the skin away.
You got it. And you've got nails. And you've got nail splinting. I'm going to get to that in a moment. You've got nail splinting, which involves putting something underneath the nail, and basically it's a combination of just pulling the nail up, but then also giving reinforcements to the nails, so allowing the nail to start. The skin is trying to go up, but as long as you've got something wedged under the nail, the skin isn't going to be able to go up. Now, all of these are nail-based procedures. Naughty, naughty nail, bad nail. It's an ingrown nail problem. Now, in fact, the procedure that you're talking about looks at it on the other side. Maybe it's a skin problem. I do not know that procedure. I know that it exists. I know that it has a very good success rate. I know it can be done. You can look it up on your own. And effectively, that procedure involves cutting away the skin to allow for the nail to keep going. So there you go. If you got to remove for a wedge resection, you've got your angry-looking area here. Before you put your scissors into your nail, you might want to freeze first, please. To freeze, what you do is you want to do a digital block. You want to inject here. You want to inject here. And in fact, if you want to achieve hemostasis, you can even put a little rubber band around. Now, when you do a rubber band tourniquet, whatever you do, for the love of God, don't just wrap the rubber band tourniquet around and leave it on and then do the procedure, because it's happened that you can leave the rubber band on and you forget about it, and several hours or days later the patient says, can I take the rubber band off? Or, I think there's a problem, but of course the patient doesn't feel the pain because you've frozen the area anyway, so he doesn't feel, and he knows it's going to feel wonky anyway because you've done the surgical procedure, so he's not paying attention to the fact that you left this rubber band on. If you are doing a rubber band tourniquet, in whether you're talking about a digit or whatever, do it the safe way, which is you still have the rubber band, but you also want to use a hemostat clamp, and you can basically turn it around, rub it around, and clamp it. Now, you've got a big hemostat clamp, and if the patient's going to walk home with a hemostat clamp stuck to his foot, that's special. And if you're going to leave the hemostat clamp on, that's also special because you just lost a hemostat clamp in addition to losing the patient's toe. But it seriously does help to prevent medical errors, catastrophic medical errors, which is a very easy safeguard to prevent such a catastrophic error. Once you've frozen your and you've compromised the blood flow, you want to basically do blunt dissection down. You want to cut all the way down, and then you want to grab onto it and pull it off, and it will always look like such a neat, clean procedure as it does here. In fact, I don't like taking nails out either. In fact, what happens often is it breaks here. You don't have a full hemostasis, so it starts bleeding. You don't even have proper anesthesia either, so the patient's starting to swear, at which point the doctor starts swearing also. And then you're trying to fish out this part of nail which is stuck under the skin. It's not a happy, feel-good procedure. But you know what? If it's got to be done, you can do it. We're laughing here, but once it's done, and the patient hates you for it, but after it's done, it's like going to the dentist. No one wants to go to a dentist, but hey, once it's done, it's like, yeah, I went to the dentist. Or, yeah, I had my nail fixed. Toenail splinting. Oh, there's an ugly picture of an angry toenail, and there you go, you've got your skin which is building up over, you've got, like, you can see even the cellulitis going around here, you've got probably angry, I wouldn't want to be walking on that. Basically, a toenail splinting, you put your little cotton swab under. Now, if you asked me which would I rather have, the surgical procedure or the cotton swab? I'd go with the cotton swab myself. If you can do a toenail splinting, do it. In fact, this is what I was talking about by applying reinforcements to that battle between the nail and the skin. You're basically helping the nail grow out, and you're not allowing the skin to grow over. You can leave there up to you can leave it well change it for up to about 3 months, and so this is a long procedure. But what you're doing is you're allowing the time for you're allowing the time for the nail to grow, and you're allowing the time for the skin to realize that it can't grow. Back to the Reno Depot, you've got your bolt cutters, you've got your Dremel tool, but you also have your hammer, and when you're hammering, you miss whatever you're hammering, and you smack your nail. You've got your little hematoma there. Why does this hurt like the dickens? Besides the fact that you just have hit your finger with a nail, with a hammer. Pressure. It's the pressure that hurts the most. In fact, in medicine, pain often is related to pressure. Not always, but often. In fact, you've got a closed area and you've got bleeding. You've got your space. Here we go. Got a nice, thin area, which is very little bit of tissue, and you've got bone on one side and you've got hard nail on the other side. And in fact, you now have pressure. And that hurts a whole lot. In fact, usually if you touch just the tip to cause a little bit of blanching, just a little bit like that, usually the patient will scream, yell, jerk their hand away, or try to slap you. Don't do that, doctor. That hurts a lot. That's a good indication that you've got yourself a subungual hematoma. What do you do about it? How do you drain it?
Laterally.
What?
Laterally.
Like that? No, please, no. How do you drain it?
Through the nail.
Through the nail. Right through the nail. In fact, you can use, you can burn it. You can burn it. We are all smokers and we all have Bic lighters, so we can all use a paper clip, heat it, and burn it. In fact, I hope none of you smoke. In fact, you can also use an electrocautery tip if you have it. If you don't, you can use a needle. You take your needle, use a big needle, like an 18-gauge needle, nice and big and angry looking here. And what you do is you put it on the nail, attach it onto your handle, also known as a syringe, and you just turn it like this. And you don't, you're not driving it in there. You're just gently turning it. And what happens is these things are razor sharp. These things are, hey, they're needles. They're sharp as a needle. And what happens is you put it on the nail, and just by turning it, you're actually going to be scraping away at the, you're going to be boring a little hole in the nail. As soon as you see a little bit of blood coming out, you know that you've broken through. At that point, you've got a decision to make. Do you keep boring or do you stop? And it depends on the type of needle you're using. I'm going to pass this needle around. You're going to see that it's got a bevel on it. If you forget that there's a bevel on it and you're using the top of the needle as your measure, it means you're going to have to go that deep. You lose points for going that deep. And in fact, the hole on the top is going to be big, and it's going to be a taper hole that you're going to be drilling. So keep in mind that the hole isn't this big. The hole is as big as the smallest point in the hole. So look at that bevel. Look at how deep it is. If you want to have a shorter bevel, you want to use a smaller gauge needle.
And when you remove that, like, how do you, does it just grow out properly?
What do you mean? So I go like that, and I put a hole in your nail. If there were no risk associated with the procedure, I would do it on you right now. You probably wouldn't be too thrilled, though. Basically, what happens is you just go like that. Once you get your hole, you end up with, here you go, it looks like, there, you got two holes there. What you're going to see is you're going to see a little bit of blood that comes out. It doesn't come up too well in the picture. Well, you can see that. You've got a little bit of blood that's going to come out. It's not going to, like, pools and pools of blood here. We're talking like a little boop, and that's it. Or maybe two little boop, boop, and that's it. And you've just decompressed it. That's all there is to it. There's nothing else to it. The needle you throw away, and you just leave it. Just leave it. What's going to happen? You're going to have two little holes there, and your nail's going to grow with two little holes. And that's it. whether or not the whole nail has to be removed, and you need proper suturing. Basically, if the whole nail is completely smashed up, you may want to. They may need more than just a little hole. You want to make sure that they don't have an underlying fracture of the distal phalanx. You want to make sure they don't have an open fracture. You want to make sure that you're not giving them an open fracture by boring this needle all the way into the bone. But if there is a major hematoma, you may want to have them seen by a plastic surgery, or you may want to do further investigations. Yes?
What if the blood is clotted?
If the blood is clotted, I would like to think that the pain would be less, that the body would have adapted. The pain is because it's growing, it's liquid, it's growing. But once it's there and it's clotted, you're seeing them 24 hours later. You can still do it. Like I said, I could put a hole in your nail right now. It's not going to kill you, and it's not even going to hurt you. It's a painless procedure. If it's done properly, because you're going in the nail doesn't hurt at all. The pain is the fact that while you're doing this, you're pushing on the pressure, and you're actually temporarily increasing the pressure. That's why the patient is going to be in pain. That's nothing to do with when you cut your nails, it doesn't hurt. Ouch, ouch, ouch. It doesn't hurt. It's nails. So, you know, if the person says, well, I hit my hand a week ago, and you think maybe it's not clotted, or you say, well, I could try, you could always try. You don't guarantee that you'll actually succeed. Don't pierce your patients. Wax impaction. Have you done ear irrigations? Have you seen ear irrigations? Some yes, most no. Wow. So, oops. There was a little bit of water in that. Now it's on my laptop. Effectively, for wax impaction, you can. What happens is people have wax in their ears. Ha! Surprise, surprise. And to remove the wax, the number one thing to do is to do nothing. Leave it alone. Don't put Q-tips in your ears. Don't put washcloths in your ears. Leave your ears alone. The outside of your ear, you wash your ear normally. The inside of your ear, don't touch it. If you do that, the probability of getting a wax impaction is very low. If you start putting Q-tips in your ears, you're going to create a big wax plug, and you're going to create a wax plug. That's not cool. Wax is your friend in your ear. But sometimes even people who have very hairy ears or are excessive wax productions can still get wax plugs even if they don't use Q-tips and they follow your advice. It's quite telling when you look into the ear and you see a nice ball of wax with a big imprint of a Q-tip and say, did you use Q-tips? And they go, no! And you say, well, there's a big wax imprint on your wax plug. And they go, well, I washed my ears this morning. And what they've done is they've just mushroomed out their wax and then they've created a wax plug. So if you go to an ENT procedure, they've got these fancy stereoscopic binoculars, which is very, very cool, with a magnifying glass and everything, and you're looking through this, and the ear looks about this big, and it's like you can slice and dice inside, you can do everything. I mean, it's like super, it's really, really quite cool. I would encourage you all to, at the very least, at the Montreal Children's, to have a beautiful setup. But for us humble family doctors, what do we do? The simple way to remove it is oil and irrigation. So we tell the patient, if it looks hard, you can tell the patient to put mineral oil in their ear, put one drop a day. It'll go in, it will become one with the oil, it will all get soft, and then when they come back a week or two later, it will all look pretty yucky. But when you irrigate, it'll come out a lot easier. In fact, irrigation is what we have here. You'll also see ear curettes, which look like a stick with a little loop on the end and a blunt loop on the end that you can put in and you can go and pull out the wax. Ear curettes, I would encourage you to use them if the wax you can see with the naked eye and it's like right there. If you got to use your otoscope and you got to go in with your otoscope, keep in mind that you do not have binocular visions. You are having monocular vision, so judging depth is harder. You do not have a big magnifying glass. It is a harder procedure, much harder procedure for family doctors to do than ENT doctors. So you will see experienced ENT doctors like slicing and dicing inside, and you'll say, oh, I can do that in my office. Don't. In fact, your curettes really should be on for the very outside only. For the love of God, don't get an ear curette mixed up with a skin biopsy, because they look pretty similar. They're quite different. A skin biopsy is also a stick with a loop on the end, but the loop is razor sharp, and it's designed to scrape off like a basal cell carcinoma. Don't put that in the ear. You lose points. So how do we remove the wax? You got a nozzle, a fancy nozzle, and you've got a fancy syringe. Now, in fact, there's still water in this. The fancy syringe, I'll get you one of these days. The fancy syringes usually have a little shield around it to prevent splashback. But for regular people, we have just a regular 60cc syringe. You can use a 5cc syringe. You can use a 10cc syringe. At another place that I work, I was using a 3cc syringe with maybe about 1 inch plastic tubing on a butterfly, on a butterfly intravenous, and that worked fine because I'm just squirting 3cc's at a time. But I can work the catheter all the way in and go, and a little wax came out, and it did the job. Basically, you want to position the person. Can I have a volunteer here? I've already used you once for the nail. Here, you can have a seat here. So basically, you position, you've got your otoscope, and I'm looking, and I say, wow, you got a big wax ball in there. And so then I take my, I'm not going to, load it up with water. Can you help me out here? Here, you can just hold this here. Great. Now, typically, I would have her take off her sweater, and I would put lots of drapes and everything, because this is going to make a mess. There's going to get water poured all over her. You take this, and you position yourself properly, so you're standing behind the patient, not in front of the patient. And you can go, and you can put it in. You guys can actually come here and have a look if you want. Basically, what you're doing is you're going in about that far into the ear. You're going in about this far into the ear, and that's all you're doing. It's a blind procedure, but typically, I've already looked to see where the wax ball is. I'm going in about that far into your ear. And what happens is I'm going in until I lose sight of it, and then I'm going a little bit further, and that's it. And that's it. Then once I'm there, I can decide. I can have a mental image of what the wax looks like, and I can squirt up and squirt in whichever direction I want to squirt in. And when you squirt, please, you don't want to squirt like this, which is really, really slow. No, you want to squirt fast. Let the water out. The water, you have to build up pressure. You got to pull the wax ball out. What temperature water do I use? That's all. And then once it's done, after every time you inject, you want to have a look, see what you've done. Make sure that what you've seen is what should be going on. What? Lukewarm. Why? Why does cold water or hot water make you dizzy?
Activates the endolymph, which migrates and causes the vestibular system to...
Yeah. And you have to counsel the patient. You might feel a little dizzy after the procedure. If you don't get the temperature bang on, which most of the time you won't, you can actually create convection currents, which activates your semicircular canals and makes you feel kind of wonky and weird. And that's it. Keep doing it. 5, 6, 7, 8. Usually at about the 10th irrigation, I give up and I stop. Again, there's something wrong. The wax is too hard. The wax is too deep. They've packed it in and packed it in and packed it in. If you're suspicious of an otitis media, or if you're suspicious of a perforated eardrum, it's not a good idea to irrigate. Don't irrigate. Questions about irrigation? Other office-based procedures, electrocardiograms. I'm not going to talk about it. You can do it in your office-based procedure. Basically, you install the leads and make the patient not move and hit the go button. If it doesn't work, it's probably because you didn't put the leads on properly. that covers the basis. If you haven't done EKG, if you haven't done your own EKGs, try to do it during your family med rotation. If that's not an option, when you're in the hospital, do your own EKGs. and get practice, you should be able to be comfortable to install, to do an EKG. It should take you about 2 minutes. If it takes you any longer, it's because you're not comfortable. You should do more. And if you ask the nurses, can I do the EKGs instead of you? They will be very thankful, and they will say, sure. And then you'll get lots of experience. Other office-based or emergency room-based procedures is a ring removal. I'm working in the shop, and I hit my hand, and my finger swells up, and I have to take my ring off. I can't take my ring off. Or I was playing with a bolt, and I put up my finger on a bolt, and I can't take it off. You have non-destructive processes and destructive processes. You can wrap the finger, just wrap it. Elevation, what you're doing is you're just basically lowering the edema and you're making the diameter easier to pull the ring off. You want to put oil and soap and all that stuff to make it slippery and it'll come out. If you want to do a destructive removal, you have a ring cutter, or you could also use a Dremel tool. Remember, that Dremel tool comes in handy. Ring cutters are these little, it looks like a can opener, a cross between a can opener and a little thumb-powered a circular saw. Basically, you have a thin metal cup on the bottom, you have a circular saw blade that can come down on the top, but the circular saw blade is turned by a thumb screw, basically. So, I mean, it's an extremely safe instrument. And you just slip the metal shield under the ring, this goes on top, and you just turn it gently, and it's extremely sharp teeth, and it just cuts through the steel or metal or whatever it is, and you can cut through. You want to cut through one, bend it open, try to take it off, or make two cuts and remove a segment, whatever the pieces that you're cutting. If you have a gold ring, you're in luck. Gold ring, gold cuts are really easy. Gold is soft, that's good. If it's a 14-carat gold, you're really in luck. 14, 18-carat, that's nice, beautiful. A hardened steel bolt, First of all, you'll destroy your little thumb screw. You'll blunt all the teeth. You may have to go over with a Dremel tool, and you'll have to go through a number of cutting bits. When you use a Dremel tool, this is a power tool. This does not have a safety measure. Yeah, you can cut the finger off if you're not careful. It cuts with friction. Friction on metal gets hot. Metal is a really good conductor. You don't want to give the patient third-degree burns around their finger, so you also want to use proper irrigation, and you want to have maybe somebody else sit there with a syringe. And then maybe you might want to just start dripping water onto it, otherwise you'll burn the patient. For the past 7 years, MacGyver, I guess he was on for 7 years, I've done nothing but travel around the world getting shot up, locked up, blown up, and all I have to show for it are a couple of empty rolls of duct tape. It all boils down to duct tape. With enough duct tape, I can fix anything. Fred Green should have done this. A family practice doc, an internist and a surgeon, and a pathologist are all out one day hunting duck. I like ducks, by the way. I didn't come up with this joke. First up is the family doctor. He raises his gun to take aim at the flock. Says to himself, it looks like a duck, it flies like a duck, it quacks like a duck, must be a duck. Bang! Bags himself a duck. The internist steps up, raises his gun, says, looks like a duck, flies like a duck, quacks like a duck, reel out quail, reel out pheasant, goose versus duck, likely. Bang! He bangs himself a duck. The surgeon raises his gun over his head and just goes, bang, 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 bang. Birds are falling all over the place. He picks one up, hands it to the pathologist and says, tell me if it's a duck. And the moral of the story is all three of them got a duck. There's more than one way that you can get yourself a duck. And they all did it in their way that works best for them. And that's it. Thank you very much. Do you guys have any questions about what we've talked about? Great. And yeah, do consider a career in addiction medicine, csam.org. My little plug for addiction medicine. Thank you.